Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On October 19th, the Norris Group proudly presented I Survived Real Estate 2012. An incredible lineup of industry experts joined Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and the outlook for real estate in the coming year. Over $77,000 was raised to benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners. Foreclosure Radar, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, the Investors Workshops, Invest Club for Women, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, Fry Wiles, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. Learn more about the panel and how to attend at isurvivedrealestate.com.
For all of us, that single-family dwelling is probably the most important financial decision that we'll make. And having some kind of support for that financial decision is extremely important. And having a qualified, educated appraiser work on that appraisal, someone who's local, someone who has expertise in the market, someone who understands what's going on in the market is key to helping consumers make that decision and to shoring up the process that we now have ongoing.
So it just goes to show that you can't rely on simply an appraisal to make a loan.
You can't rely on what now?
You can't rely solely on an appraisal to make your lending decision. You have to rely on, there are a number of other factors that are going to determine whether somebody gets paid back or not.
Okay. All right, let's talk about the appraisal management companies designed to provide a barrier between the appraiser and the rest of the participants, the goal being appraiser independence. Has that occurred?
I think to some degree it has. I think that one of the big problems we're seeing from the AMCs and their emergence into the world of appraisal, obviously they were set up and put together to provide that firewall between the lender and the purchaser. And the idea is a good one. But unfortunately what's happened is in a lot of instances, and not all of them, but in a lot of instances, the mantra of the AMC seems to be cheap and quick. And what we're seeing is that we're sacrificing the ability of an appraiser who is local, with local expertise, with understanding of the market, with the ability to investigate and put together an appraisal that is accurate for a specific part of the market that person works in, being negated by the insistence that the fee be very low and the timing be very quick. We're seeing a lot of people who are traveling into markets 200, 300, 400 miles, who come in, make an inspection, gather up what they can on the quick, go home, do the appraisal, and it's turned in 24, 36 hours. And, you know, for all of us, that single-family dwelling is probably the most important financial decision that we'll make. And having some kind of support for that financial decision is extremely important. And having a qualified, educated appraiser work on that appraisal, someone who's local, someone who has expertise in the market, someone who understands what's going on in the market is key to helping consumers make that decision and to shoring up the process that we now have ongoing.
Have you been watching the debates?
Oh.
No, I'm kidding.
Yes, I have.
That's a very full answer. Who owns the appraisal management companies typically?
Well, in many instances, the large financial institutions have a huge, huge part in some of these AMCs. Some of them are independent and small. It just depends.
Okay. If I was appraising in 2005 and I'm appraising in 2012, how has my income been affected?
In most instances, for many of our residential appraisers, I'm speaking from the surveys that the Appraisal Institute has conducted with its SRA members who are designated to do specifically residential work and have expertise in that market, we're seeing that many of our appraisers are earning 50% less than they did in 2005. And many are leaving the market. Many are leaving the industry looking for other things to do. I mean, let's face it. You can't support your family in 2012 earning 50% of what you earned in 2005. It's unfortunate. It's very unfortunate.
Now, there is a notion that no one can talk to the appraiser about a transaction. That's not true, is it?
That's correct.
It's correct that it's not true?
It's correct that it's not true.
Okay.
You can speak to that appraiser.
And, okay.
You know, one of the things that we tell our folks all the time, and when we've spoken about this in other venues, the buyer and the seller need to be proactive people. You need to understand what your market is, where you're going. We depend on our realtor friends to help in that particular process. We've said always that an appraisal is as good as the information that's used to develop it. And we encourage our appraisers to ask questions. Our SRAs understand how to conduct an appraisal, how to gather that data, how to interface with an owner to find out what's happening in that particular market, in that particular home. You know, if you've added energy-efficient windows and doors and you have a new heating and air, that appraiser needs to know. That you can't leave those things to just blind luck. So you have to be proactive. The appraiser has to be open to information. And that's when we get this market moving again and this appraisal process becoming a positive thing.
When you testified in front of Congress, you used the term that the appraisers were experiencing scope creep. Can you explain what scope creep is?
Right. As I did testify in late June before the before Congress, with regard to many of the problems that our appraisers, and specifically our residential appraisers, are finding, we are seeing more and more of the scope of work being dictated by our AMCs. They want more comparables. They want more information. Generally, an appraiser might use 3 to 5 comparable sales. Many of the lenders are the AMCs are now requiring 9 or 10. They're imposing on some of the things that we as appraisers do in the general part of business and making it more and more difficult, I think, for appraisers to perform.
In the review process, which I'm thinking most appraisals now are reviewed, if the review suggests a lower appraisal value, which value will be used for the transaction typically?
It's my understanding that probably the review value would be used over the appraisal value, and that's very problematic because in many instances the people who are doing that review are not trained. They probably have very, very little experience and expertise in the appraisal process. It is a matter of asking for more and more and more information and less weight being placed on that information.
And lastly, is there any negative ramifications for the appraiser that came in with one value and had that appraisal lowered by some process? Is there some black mark that says you're no longer on our list? Is there a danger of not getting assignments?
I can't speak to that from experience. Anecdotally, we've heard that from appraisers that the list of qualified people is certainly expanded or declined and decreased by the interface they might have with the reviewers and also with the performance that they have with regard to how those reviews are conducted. Yes.
Last question. We're used to seeing an appraiser with initials behind their name.
Right.
Is that a way to get more assignments, is to have some of those initials? Is that meaningful in today's appraisal world?
I'm not so sure it's meaningful from the standpoint of revenue. I think that it's absolutely necessary from the standpoint of credibility. I think that folks who have gone the extra mile to become professionally designated by a recognized organization are out in front with expertise, with technique, with understanding of the market, with the tools to analyze that market, and certainly provide the consumer, whoever that consumer may be, with the most up-to-date, authoritative information that can be gleaned in the appraisal business.
If an appraisal management company is making a decision between you and I, and appraisal assignment comes up, and I say, "Well, I'll do that for $225 and have it to you tomorrow," and I have no designations, and you say you need $300, and it's going to be 2 days, will I likely be getting the appraisal?
You'll get the deal.
Okay, that's what I kind of thought.
Got it.
So the formula to get an edge in the appraisal business is: do it cheap, do it quick, and come in conservatively on your price. It doesn't sound like an industry that they've helped out very much, to be honest with you.
Well, I think that, again, not all of the AMCs operate like
okay.
that, but we're talking about a vast majority. And it's very, very troubling to believe that, the most important financial decision that most Americans make is the purchase of a dwelling. That's huge. And I know that these guys will back me up with that. But to make it a commoditized kind of experience in terms of the documentation that one has going forward is to me absolutely short-sighted. It puts this whole process at risk. We're the only part of a real estate transaction that doesn't have an interest in terms of the sales price, whether it sells or not. We're there to report the data. We're there to analyze the market. And we're not there to verify a listing price. We're not there to verify anyone's opinion. We're there to give an opinion based on solid data, our skills, and our expertise. And I think that we've always played an important part in the real estate community. We're going to have to continue to play a big part in the real estate community to continue recovery, to get us back to the point where we need to be and want to be in this housing market.
Thank you.
Thank you.
EJ, yes, please. EJ, Dodd-Frank was passed in 2010. Do we know what it says yet?
About that much. No, there are. I've actually lost track of how many rules are past the deadline.
Is there any importance in January 1, 2013? Is that supposed to be a date where that it's now decided on?
Yeah. I think that's when I think that was the original implementation date for a number of the rules. They're now saying, that the rule I think everybody's looking for, at least in this room, would be QM, and that's when I believe they're talking about coming out again, with the recomment. But I personally, I'm not sure when we'll see it.
I'm sorry, you're not sure what?
When we'll see it?
Okay. Well, have we made progress on what they intend to do? Because the original intention was pretty restrictive. If that had been implemented, something like 16% of the loans that were funded in the last decade would have met the criteria.
Right. I think that in the beginning, the regulators had a thought that, if you needed to have 20% down payment.
Right.
And really, really a big focus on down payment, ignoring the impact that having a job has on your ability to repay, and I think the it seems that perhaps over the last year or so we've seen a movement away from that and a recognition that if you're going to focus on a large down payment, you're going to cut a huge portion of the buying public out of the market, and in terms of just the whole economic spectrum of buyers, you're going to end up with buyers that are going to pretty much all look the same. So that, from that standpoint, I think we're encouraged.
Are what type of loans are exempt from the QRM standards?
From the QRM standards?
Yes.
We don't have them yet.
Well, okay. Is there any group of loans that will be exempt? So if it's is it Fannie or Freddie or?
Well, Fannie and Freddie, while they're under conservatorship, they're not subject to the risk retention rules,
right?
Which would make them, you know, they would not be subject to QRM then.
Okay.
But today we don't really know what the rule is going to be, so.
Okay.
And at some point, Fannie and Freddie will go out of it.
Well, let's talk about that. Does that present a problem if you're a lender? And let's talk about risk retention.
Sure.
Risk retention is part of what's supposed to be settled.
Right.
Is it unsettling not to have it settled?
Well, I think if you look at the two markets that use securitization, residential, commercial, on the commercial side, there are a number of nuances in the Dodd-Frank rule, which allow people to get to avoid risk retention.
Okay,
those haven't quite been settled yet, but I think there's less concern over on the commercial side.
Right.
On the residential side, I think we're at least in, and I'm speaking now from the mortgage banker's perspective. There are a number of smaller, independent mortgage bankers that are very concerned that if they have to retain risk, you know, that could put them out of business. However, I would say today they're less focused on that than they are on the repurchase issues. And that probably has a more chilling effect on the market today than you know, worrying about what QRM will actually look like.
Okay, let's talk about repurchase issues. How far back can that go? You funded a loan 3 years ago.
It can go back to the day you made the loan. I think that's right now, from talking to my friends, you know, that are independent mortgage bankers, I think that's one of the biggest issues we've got. I think the idea that if you missed one piece of paper that's probably inconsequential, they can say, "Gotcha, you buy that loan back."
Well, what if? Okay, now isn't it true that if that loan already has been foreclosed on, that could also occur? Is that?
Sure.
Okay, so the loan could not even exist anymore. It
sure.
went to foreclosure, it got resold as an REO, and 6 years after you funded the loan and 2 years after it was an REO, you get called back and say, write a check at par?
You could. Yes, you
okay.
could. But, you know, fact of the matter is, you know, most of the repurchase claims are occurring, you know, once the loan becomes seriously delinquent.
Okay. Gary, we're going to spend another 5 minutes, and then we'll break, and then we'll have you guys back in action after we do the two other guys. Let's say, you know, you work in Orange County predominantly, okay?
Correct.
Let's say you had a single family buyer, well qualified, great FICO score, good healthy down payment, and you have even a lender letter. They're qualified, and you make an offer on a property at full price every day for a month. Would you buy one?
Depends on what the price range is that you're making the offer in. But if you're in the affordable price range, it's going to be tough.
Okay.
You're going to make multiple offers before you get one.
But you still would probably get one. I just wanted to make
sure. Eventually, you would. Yes, but fortunately or unfortunately, in Orange County, we currently have approximately 40 days worth of inventory, so you know it's next to nothing.
Yeah, and how's that changed in say 6 months? What 6 months ago was it?
Six months ago, it was a little higher, but not a whole lot higher. A year ago, it was quite a bit higher.
Where is there pressure in the marketplace that hasn't existed before? In other words, is it coming from the large hedge fund buyers, investors, or just
here's. You know, the problem is this. We had so many properties that were underwater and still do. So those sellers aren't putting their property on the market. We don't have as many foreclosures as you alluded to in your opening remarks. So that's down. The number of short sales are down. And so we have a restricted supply, and a lot of people are realizing that now is the time to buy because they've done the rent analysis and have analyzed that it's better to buy than to rent. So we have the pressure of a number of buyers getting off the fence and ready to buy, and we don't have the inventory to sell them.
If you have a short sale candidate, and you've probably witnessed it, what percentage of them are actually getting offers of cash to cooperate with a short sale? The lender's offering them money to do that.
As a seller with the offer of cash to go through with a short sale, we haven't experienced a whole lot of those yet.
Okay.
Most of them have been, you know, if we can get out from under the property in a short sale, we'd rather do that than have the property foreclosed on. And so they're willing to work that through. Takes time, though.
Okay. Well, has that improved?
Somewhat, but not a lot.
Okay.
You know, it is better than it was, you know, when we first started into short sales, because most of the lenders have ramped up with the staffing to be able to handle them better. But in the beginning, the staff wasn't there, nor the expertise, so it was difficult to get them through. But it's still a lengthy time.
The issue of debt forgiveness not being taxable at the end of the year that expires or gets extended.
Correct.
Do you have a sense of what's likely to occur with that?
We still think there's a 90% chance that it will be extended, so we don't think that it's going to go away.
If it did go away...
That's going to be a chilling effect on the market.
That would be a very chilling effect on the market, yep. Absolutely. What about when you see inventory sold in bulk, either notes or bulk REOs? Is that something you think is unnecessary completely?
Absolutely, and we've told that to both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that is something we don't agree with, especially in California. It's unneeded. In some areas, maybe it is. Maybe it's a good idea, but in California in particular, no. And most of the hardest hit areas, take Florida or Arizona or California, they've healed rapidly. And so bulk REOs don't make any sense.
Do you see investors getting short sale offers accepted when you know they're not going to occupy it? Do you see any percentage going to investors?
Most of the investing that I've seen has been in the REO side, not on the short sale side.
There's not a lot of REOs, so we've changed gears, let me tell you.
Understand.
We're very flexible.
and cash does talk to anybody.
You know, it is one of those things it's absolutely necessary in any career, right? I mean, whether you're a mortgage broker or you're a realtor or you're an appraiser, I mean, you have to stay on top of this, and investors are no different. We have to learn how to switch gears and do what's appropriate and to stay in business. Because, you know, we do have the willingness to do that. Most of us will be here next year. Despite the odds, you know, we'll show up here again next year and have had a successful year. And I think that's important.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate. Adrenaline Athletics, California Property Solvers, Coldwell Banker Pioneer Real Estate, Elite Auctions, For Investors by Investors, In a Day Development, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts Incorporated, Keller Williams of Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, Lievis Associates, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Pilot Limo, Realty 411 Magazine, Real Wealth Network, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Association of Realtors, John Reisinger Photography, Sonoka Corporation, Spinnaker Loans, UDirect IRA, Wilson Investment Properties, Tony Alvarez, Weston South Coast Plaza, and Winning in Tough Times, LLC. See isurvivedrealestate.com for the video from the live event.